Catra Podcast Conversations for the Curious, Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Catra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're going to need to maybe set aside some of our usual ideas about life itself, because we are diving into, well, one of the most powerful, maybe provocative scientific books ever written, Richard Dawkins' 1976 classic, The Selfish Gene. And this isn't, you know, just another biology book. It's really a kind of mind-bending paradigm shift. It forces you, the listener, to sort of completely rethink who you are, why you exist. It gives this single, really revolutionary answer to that fundamental question. Why do living things, us included, behave the way they do?
Yeah. And what's so fascinating, I think, is that the book's nearly 50 years old now. But the ideas, well, they feel more relevant than ever. This isn't just some dusty old science text. It gives us this crucial, almost cold, logical lens. We needed to understand everything from, say, complex family bonds or why we feel guilt, all the way up to analyzing why certain catchy slogans, memes, basically spread like wildfire on social media. It's all connected.
So our mission today, then, is to really dig into what Dawkins synthesized. Why did it feel like such a scientific, even philosophical revolution back then? We need to figure out what evolution is actually selecting for. What's the real unit here?
Okay, yeah, let's unpack that. Maybe we should start with the man behind the argument. Mm-hmm. Who exactly is Richard Dawkins? Well, Dawkins is a world-renowned evolutionary biologist, an ethologist, too. He came out of Oxford. Mm-hmm. Studied under Nico Tinbergen, who actually won a Nobel Prize.
Wow.
Yeah, a giant in studying animal behavior. Mm. And that background matters, you know? Dawkins wasn't just stuck in a lab. He was grounded in observing real animal behavior. Mm. But he was always looking for that deeper theoretical explanation for it all.
Right. So he was more than just a reporter of science. He was a synthesizer, wasn't he? He took these really complex, sometimes very mathematical theories that were kind of bubbling up in specialized academic circles, like W.D. Hamilton's work on kin selection and John Maynard Smith using game theory for biology. He pulled all that together.
Exactly. And his real authority, I think, comes from this incredible skill he has, taking these abstract, maybe even intimidating ideas and making them just compellingly accessible for everyone. He's got this unique talent for crafting powerful analogies, you know, phrases that just stick in your head, like survival machines or immortal coils. Mm-hmm. He made this gene's eye view not just understandable, but almost intuitive.
Okay, so let's get right to the core of the book then. If you had to boil down that central premise, the big idea that changes everything, what is it?
The premise is pretty stark, really, and simple. Yeah. The fundamental unit of selection, the thing that actually survives, gets copied, the thing that's effectively immortal, it's not the species, it's not the group, it's not even the individual organism we see, it's the gene.
The gene, and the immediate implication of that, that's what really forces the worldview shift, right? If the gene is the star of the evolutionary show, what does that make us?
The organisms.
And
it makes us humans, birds, plants, everything alive, just temporary survival machines, or vehicles, as he famously calls them, were built by genes, essentially for the gene's own preservation and propagation. Our bodies, they're mortal, they decay, but the information, the DNA code they carry, that's functionally immortal, passed down generation after generation.
That survival machine metaphor is so powerful. So the book's purpose then was to systematically take apart that older idea, the group selection theory.
Yeah, that more maybe sentimental idea that organisms behave for the good of the species. Dawkins argued against that. He wanted to replace it with this rigorous gene-centric view, which is, frankly, much more logical and matches the evidence better. It doesn't need these fuzzy ideas about group loyalty. Instead, it gives us this elegant mechanism to explain behaviors that were huge puzzles for biology, especially the biggest puzzle, altruism. Why help others?
And the scope is just huge. One of the most famous parts is extending this whole replication idea beyond DNA into culture with the meme. But, okay, before we get to memes and culture, we probably need to go way back, like to the very beginning of life.
We really do. Chapter 2 of the book, it takes us right back to that chemical soup, the primordial soup, where that first spark of evolution happened. The first thing that mattered wasn't really life as we know it. It was the first replicator. Just a molecule that could somehow make copies of itself.
Right. And for that replicator to actually succeed, to become common, it needed, what, three key things?
Exactly. Three properties. Longevity, it had to stick around, be stable. Fecundity, it needed to copy itself reasonably fast. And crucially, copying fidelity. It had to make accurate copies, mostly. but with just enough errors, mutations, to allow for change and improvement over time.
So genes, DNA, they're the modern, highly evolved versions of that original replicator, the immortal coils, as he puts it.
That's it. They persist, they get passed on, while the survival machines they build, our bodies, are just temporary, disposable in a way, like suits of armor that wear out.
Okay, this is where it starts to get really philosophically heavy, isn't it? If we're just temporary vehicles, where does the gene's influence actually end? Is it just contained within our skin?
Ah, that's a brilliant question. And that leads to this truly mind-bending concept you develop later called the extended phenotype. Dawkins argues that a gene's effect, its phenotypic expression, isn't actually limited to the body it lives in. It reaches out into the world.
Wait, so like when a beaver builds a dam, that dam is, in a way, part of the beaver's genes expressing themselves.
Precisely. The genes aren't just coding for fur color or teeth size. They're coding for the behavior that results in the dam. The dam is an extended phenotype of the beaver's genes.
Wow.
Or think about a cuckoo chick. Hatches in another bird's nest, right? It manipulates its host parent, a totally different species, into feeding it. The cuckoo's genes are literally extending their manipulative power across species boundaries. It's a huge shift in perspective. The genes reaches, well, potentially everywhere.
Okay. Let's tackle the big one then. Altruism. Why on earth would any creature risk its own life, its own chance to reproduce, to help another one? Especially if selection is acting on the individual. It just doesn't seem to make sense evolutionarily.
This was the massive problem that W.D. Hamilton really cracked. And Dawkins brought Hamilton's idea, kin selection, to a huge audience. The insight is this. Apparent individual self-sacrifice is often just gene-level selfishness in disguise. The gene programs the individual vehicle to help other vehicles that are likely carrying copies of itself. Relatives, basically.
Right, because you share, what, 50% of your genes with a full sibling on average?
Exactly. So from the gene's perspective, if sacrificing yourself allows, say, three of your siblings to survive and reproduce when they otherwise wouldn't have, well, statistically, your genes win that exchange. More copies get passed on overall.
And the classic example, the really clear biological proof, is in the social insects, right? Ants, bees, wasps.
Oh, absolutely. Stunning examples. Think about a sterile worker ant. She'll never reproduce herself. Her entire life is devoted to helping the queen reproduce.
Which seems like the ultimate act of altruism.
Only at the individual level. Because of their weird genetics, haplodiploidy, it's called, these workers often share more genes with their sisters, about 75%, than they would with their own offspring if they could have them. So from the genes' point of view, helping the queen pump out loads of highly related sisters is a much better strategy for replicating itself than trying to go it alone. The worker ant is a vehicle, and her DNA is optimizing its copying via the whole colony structure.
Okay, that makes sense for family. Kin selection covers relatives. But what about cooperation between non-relatives? Like, if I help a stranger, they probably don't share many of my specific genes. Why would that evolve?
Right. That's where reciprocal altruism comes in. This was mainly developed by Robert Travers. It's basically the you scratch my back now, I'll scratch yours later system. But it only works under certain conditions. It tends to evolve in social species where individuals interact repeatedly. And critically, they need good memories. They have to remember who helped them and who cheated.
The famous example here is the vampire bat sharing blood meals. That makes it very concrete.
Yes, it's a great case. These bats, they die pretty quickly if they don't get a blood meal. So if one bat has a good night foraging, finds plenty of blood, it might regurgitate some to feed a roostmate who is unlucky, an unrelated roostmate even.
Seems generous.
But it's not charity. They keep track. There's a sort of mental ledger. If you receive blood but then fail to reciprocate later when that helper bat is in need, you get remembered as a cheater. And you get cut off from future help. It's mutual aid, yes, but is built entirely on calculated long-term self-interest at the genetic level. Punishment for cheaters is key.
Wow. It all sounds incredibly, well, cutthroat. If genes are always competing like this, why isn't the natural world just a constant bloody free-for-all, animals fighting to the death all the time?
Ah, that brings us to another brilliant idea from John Maynard Smith. He applied game theory from economics and math to biology, developing the concept of the evolutionarily stable strategy, or ESS. And ESS is basically a behavioral strategy like how aggressive to be in a conflict that, once most members of a population adopt it, cannot be successfully invaded or beaten by any alternative mutant strategy. It's stable because, on average, it works best when everyone else is doing it too.
So the famous hawk dove game kind of illustrates this. Being maximally aggressive, the hawk strategy isn't always the best bet in the long run.
Yeah. Exactly right. If everyone is a hawk, always fighting fiercely, then everyone ends up getting injured frequently. That lowers overall survival and reproductive success for everybody. Bad for the genes. But if everyone is a dove, always retreating, then they're easily exploited by the first hawk that appears. So the ESS often ends up being a mixed strategy, or maybe a conditional strategy, like display aggressively, but retreat if your opponent escalates fiercely. Depends on the costs and benefits. Animal conflicts often look ritualized, lots of posturing, rarely escalating to death. Not because they're being good for the species, but because unrestrained aggression is usually a poor, unstable strategy for the individual's genes. It's too costly.
This whole perspective, it really is world-altering. Let's maybe pull out some of the key themes that really change how you see yourself in the world. Theme one has got to be the big one, the toughest pill to swallow, perhaps, organisms as vehicles.
Yeah, that's the profound shift in identity, isn't it? You stop seeing yourself or any living thing as a sort of master of its own destiny. Instead, you start seeing us as these incredibly sophisticated, temporary, programmable vessels. Built by DNA for DNA's purposes, it forces you to reevaluate your own deep-seated physical desires, things like hunger or aging or the drive to find a mate. You see them as mechanisms built by the incredibly long reach of your genes to get themselves copied into the next generation.
Okay, but wait. If we're just vehicles, just programmed robots, what about free will? Doesn't that kind of make everything meaningless? How does Dawkins handle that? Does he just leave us in existential dread?
That's where theme two becomes absolutely vital. It's often misunderstood. It's the metaphor of selfishness. Dawkins is actually very careful to explain this. He says selfish is just a metaphor. It's mechanical. It's like saying gravity is selfish because it pulls things down. Genes have no motives, no consciousness, no feelings, no malice. They are just information. And they behave as if they are selfish because the ones whose consequences lead to their own successful replication become more numerous than the ones that don't. It's just physics and chemistry playing out over millennia.
Okay, so it's not a moral judgment. It's not saying we should be selfish. It's just describing how the underlying genetic mechanism works. Like saying a successful bit of computer code is selfish because it outcompetes buggy code. It just works better at copying itself.
Precisely. That distinction is so crucial. It helps avoid falling into the trap of genetic determinism, thinking our genes dictate everything and we have no choice.
Yeah.
It's descriptive, not prescriptive.
Yeah.
Very important.
Right. And yet, even within the unit we think of as most cooperative, the family. The third theme seems to be conflict is inherent. That still emerges from this view.
It does, because genetic interests are almost never perfectly aligned, even between close relatives. So you get what Robert Trivers called the battle of the generations, conflict between parents and their children over parental investment. Think about it. A parent is equally related to all their offspring, so they're selected to divide resources, food, attention, protection, more or less equally among them. But each individual child, they're 100% related to themselves and only 50% related to their siblings. So each child is genetically selected to demand more than its fair share of parental resources, often at the expense of its siblings.
That instantly explains things like sibling rivalry and maybe weaning conflicts, the terrible twos. The toddler isn't just being difficult. They're genetically programmed to try and maximize their own selfish share of mom and dad's resources.
It provides a powerful framework for understanding those dynamics, yeah. And finally, we have to touch on the cultural theme. Cultural evolution via memes.
This might be the most famous single idea from the book, maybe even more famous than the selfish gene itself for some people. The meme.
Right. He coined the term. Mm-hmm. A meme is defined as a unit of cultural transmission, a unit of imitation. It could be an idea, a catchy tune, a fashion trend, a religious belief, a scientific theory, anything that leaps from brain to brain through imitation. It evolves, in a way, in parallel with genes.
So memes compete. Let genes do.
Exactly. They compete for space in our minds, for our attention, for our memory. The memes that are better at getting themselves copied, because they're catchy, useful, emotionally appealing, whatever, spread more effectively than others. Just like successful genes spread in the gene pool.
Dawkins' writing itself is just incredibly potent. Let's share a couple of the lines that really capture the starkness, but also the potential of this view. We absolutely have to share the most famous summary line. We are survival machines, robot vehicles, blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes.
That's the setup, isn't it? It's stark. But crucially, it's followed by a line right near the end of the first edition that offers a kind of moral clarity, maybe even liberation, he says. Let us try to teach generosity and altruism because we are born selfish. Let us understand what our own selfish genes are up to, because we may then at least have the chance to upset their designs.
Ugh, that's the escape clause. That's huge. It means understanding our biological programming, our innate tendencies. That's the first step towards consciously choosing to act differently, choosing to be altruistic even when our genes might not favor it. We're the first species, maybe, that can actually look down the microscope and see our own code, understand the program.
And that leads us perfectly into thinking about real-life applications today. If we take kin selection and apply it to human families, it helps explain not just why we often feel such deep, maybe even irrational bonds with our relatives, but also why we might tolerate behavior from family that we'd never accept from a friend. We're sort of biologically programmed to invest in those related vehicles.
Yeah, that makes sense. And if we apply reciprocal altruism to human morality, it suddenly looks like a powerful explanatory tool, doesn't it? Our social emotions, things like gratitude, guilt, loyalty, even righteous anger when someone cheats the system, you can see them as these sophisticated psychological adaptations. Tools for managing that complex social ledger of who owes what to whom in society. And it perfectly explains why reputation is so incredibly important in human societies. If you get known as a cheater, someone who doesn't reciprocate, your social ledger goes bankrupt. Nobody trusts you. Nobody helps you.
Absolutely. And now let's apply memes to our world today. The modern digital landscape. Social media platforms. They are the ultimate meme ecosystems, aren't they? The ideas, the images, the slogans that replicate best, the ones that grab attention, provoke emotion, are easily shared, they outcompete others. Often completely, regardless of whether they're true or fair or valuable.
That's actually quite terrifyingly accurate when you put it like that. The algorithm isn't selecting for truth necessarily, it's selecting for replicability, engagement, virality.
Exactly. And understanding that difference, that selection pressure in the digital world, is pretty critical for navigating the information age we live in, I think.
So as we start to wrap this up, thinking about everything we've discussed, what's the greatest insight you personally take away from really absorbing this gene's eye view?
For me, I think it's the unique value of the book itself. Its power to replace these kind of vague, maybe slightly fuzzy, sentimental ideas about evolution with the clear, cold logic of replication. It takes this vast, complex world of behavior cooperation, conflict, family life, everything, and explains so much of it with one elegant, surprisingly simple core idea. It really demystifies life in a powerful way.
Yeah. What struck me hardest, I think, was that combination of ideas. First, the existential realization that we are fundamentally temporary vehicles, but then realizing that the very knowledge of that fact empowers us. If we are just these sophisticated machines built for DNA replication, then our conscious awareness, our ability to understand the mechanism itself, that's the real anomaly. That's what's special.
And that leads right to a final thought, maybe. The knowledge that we seem to be the only species on this planet that can actually understand its own programming. That gives us this unique, almost monumental power. It gives us the power to consciously choose to override some of those innate tendencies our genes might favor, like favoring kin exclusively, or being suspicious of outsiders. Nepotism, xenophobia, look at it this way. Human ethics, choosing kindness, fairness, cooperation beyond biological necessity becomes a kind of triumph, a triumph of consciousness over underlying code.
A really powerful thought to end on. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.